I'm Will Howell.
I'm Viola Giuda.
I'm Anthony Fowler, and this is Not Another Politics Podcast. We are still talking about the filibuster.
The issue about the filibuster has been the subject of historical debate in the last few months, particularly with Senator Manchin and Senator Sinema, about what it's for.
There are lots of debates, and you might say that these debates about the filibuster aren't going anywhere. They're not moving forward. And also, they're not going anywhere in the sense that probably the people who are making those arguments aren't likely to give them up anytime soon.
Senator Joe Manchin, a guy, whether you like it or not, who holds a lot of power, given his position right now in Washington, told Axios last week that he is not willing to destroy our government. That was his quote when asked about something else on the filibuster.
He once again emphasized his refusal to end the filibuster, a Senate rule which requires a 60-vote threshold to advance most legislation.
Viola, what do you think about the debates about the filibuster? Can you predict what's going to happen?
You know, always when I listen to those debates, I sort of half listen to them because I worry that nothing's going to change. We are not going to have any reforms and we are going to just proceed as we did for the last 20 or 40 years. We'll just talk to someone who has a proposal that actually has a chance of passing, I think. It's a proposal that's not only a grandiose proposal to change the rules, but it also lays out how to change them in a way that's feasible.
Yes, I had the great pleasure of talking to Ken Shepsley at Harvard, who's written a paper with Jonathan Gould and Matthew Stevenson entitled Democratizing the Senate from Within, in which they make a specific proposal on how to change the rules associated with the filibuster and how one invokes cloture, that is, how one ends the filibuster. And I'll say, look, the rules that govern the filibuster have changed a lot over time. The threshold you have to meet in order to invoke cloture, whether or not it has to be done verbally or not, whether or not the filibuster applies to appointments or not. All this has changed over time. So count me from the top among those who thinks there's room for consideration of additional change, and that in the aftermath of a whole lot of dysfunction, and boy, the Senate is good at dysfunction, there's space to actually move forward. And they are making a very specific proposal on how to move forward. Ken Shepsley, what a pleasure it is to have you on Not Another Politics Podcast. Thanks for joining us. We get to talk about this paper that you have written with two of your colleagues, Jonathan Gould and Matthew Stevenson, entitled Democratizing the Senate from Within. And I guess it's with real consequence because we're at a moment where the Senate is sort of blocking passage on all kinds of things routinely that pass by majorities within the House. And so you guys come forward with a solution to kind of open up the gates a bit. But it's not a solution that others have offered, which says, well, let's just get rid of the filibuster. Let's just vote on a straight majoritarian basis. Why don't you say sort of explicitly why you would be hesitant to simply eliminate the filibuster?
The reason we are hesitant to eliminate the filibuster is that there are really two filibuster problems. One is the problem of minority obstruction, and that has gotten all the attention. But there's a second problem, and that is related to the extreme malapportionment of the Senate. So that if the filibuster were gotten rid of and we had simple majority rule, then a small majority of senators representing a very small proportion of the population owing to malapportionment could pass things that overwhelming majority of the population disapproved of. And this, in fact, happened in the last 4 years. The Trump tax bill was barely passed in the Senate and supported by something on the order of 44% of the population. And all three of his Supreme Court nominees were confirmed by small majorities. And in all three cases, they represented in the mid-40s in terms of proportion of the population. So you had 55% of the population opposed to a Supreme Court appointment, and yet it passes.
Okay.
And getting rid of the filibuster would permit this kind of anti-majoritarian policy to occur.
Okay, so I think we've set it up. What is the specific proposal on offer?
The proposal is that Rule 22 be redrafted, or a precedent be set that in effect redrafts it, that says that the Senate may proceed to a vote if a majority of senators prefers it and that majority represents a majority of the population. Each senator would be deemed to represent half of the population of their state as determined by the most recent decennial census.
So we can imagine, we could certainly imagine instances. I think we may have one right now. If we say, for instance, that Manchin and Sinema are against a really big infrastructure bill, say, but the Democrats could readily get 48 votes, and that those 48 votes would represent a decided popular majority around the country. Nonetheless, on your proposal, that would not pass because you still have to get a majority of senators behind it, right?
Let me make two responses to that. One is that at least one of our co-authors was prepared not even to require a majority of senators to proceed to a vote, but only a number of senators representing a majority of the population. And the reason, and I would point this out, whether one requires a majority of senators or not, is that at the end of the day, to actually pass something does require a majority of senators.
I see. But let's make sure we've got the proposal on offer nailed down. You've got to have a majority of senators who represent a majority of the population in order to proceed to a vote. And what kind of effects do you imagine this having on the production of laws within the Senate? And, I mean, that one's, I think, reasonably straightforward, but behind it, too, are the politics of coalition formation. Suddenly, the dear folk who represent California matter more under your proposal than they did before because they bring with them a whole lot more popular votes in order to clear this additional threshold that you want to put into play.
Well, at one level, I mean, going back to the electoral level just for a moment, I don't think we have a lot to say about that. But California was once a Republican state, and it would become even more attractive to Republicans if it carried with it this extra bonus of its population counting in some significant way toward agenda setting in the Senate. You know, one speculation is that Republicans would be more serious about contesting statewide elections in California. Now, that California is a bit of a stretch, but there are probably other large-ish states that are now purple or blue that would be attractive targets for Republicans. So it might induce them to moderate their national message to be more competitive in larger states.
And how then do you imagine this affecting the politics of coalition formation within the Senate? Let's say we now have everybody elected. They're in the Senate. Some people are representing small states. Other people are representing big states. What shifts?
Today, a 50-vote majority of Democrats represents a majority of the population, quite overwhelmingly. Something like 55 or 56% of the population is represented by the 50 Democratic senators today. So if they were in the majority, there would be no incentive for them to change their behavior. They would not need to extend, except on a principle of bipartisanship being a good thing, they would not need the votes of Republicans. Republicans today, even if they should take the Senate in 2022, it is unlikely that their majority in the Senate would represent a majority of the population. They would need to reach across the aisle in order to pass things. The assumption would be that they would be looking at the Manchins and Sinemas, first of all, but again, looking at the more moderate Democrats and trying to woo them in order to pass legislation.
Right, but the Manchins and Sinemas represent smaller states, the West Virginia and the Arizona. And so they would have to weigh the benefits of buying off a couple or a few of moderate Democrats from small states against those. If they just got one Democrat, one maverick Democrat from California would do the trick.
Exactly.
To give them the majority of the population. And they'd have to then think about who to target.
I think that's right. And they there are many paths to a sufficient majority to pass something, whether it's many smaller Democratic states bringing them on board or a couple of larger Democratic states. The question would be a calculation on the part of the Republicans of which move would be cheaper to them.
Right.
It might be cheaper to buy off Joe Manchin, representing a small-ish state, by saying we won't get rid of coal. We'll just require scrubbers on every smokestack in the country, with or some pork barrel project moving government agency to Charleston, West Virginia, than it would be to buy off the larger vote of a California senator.
Right, right. But you'd need three or four Manchins, or maybe like 10 or 15 Manchins, right, to get up to, if all that's required, all you're looking to do is build up the popular support because you've already.
So what you're saying is one house and a lot of Manchins?
Yeah, that's good. I was wondering when we were going to get a Shepsley pun. That's terrific. Okay, so let me ask you this. In the main, is the expectation that having reduced the threshold required to actually enact laws, that then we would see an increase in legislative productivity? Is that what we ought to expect were your proposal adopted?
Well, it depends compared to what. I mean, it might be easier. It'll certainly be easier for a Democratic Senate to pass legislation because inherently at the moment they represent the majority of the population. It would be not clear whether it would be easier for a Republican to pass because the issue would be, is it easier for them to acquire a few Democratic votes with enough population or to acquire under the present rule enough votes to get to 60?
Right.
Under the current filibuster rule. And that, as I say, depends from Congress to Congress.
Yep. Okay, so I think this is a terrifically interesting proposal, and it works on a lot of levels. And it's one of those proposals that I can imagine people being intrigued by coming at the problem from very different angles. The concerns about representation, the lack of ability of Congress to respond to contemporary problems, the sense of gridlock taking hold, concerns about malapportionment. It's all kind of neatly attended to. But another way to solve the very problems you've identified is, in a simpler one in some ways, is to simply get rid of the Senate, right? We could simply eliminate the Senate, have a unicameral Congress that only consists of the House, and they vote on a straight majoritarian basis. And the House doesn't have the kind of malapportionment problem that the Senate does, and so we're free and clear. But you guys want to preserve the Senate. And is that just because you think, getting rid of the Senate is a bridge too far? Or are there things that you want to hold on to that the Senate stands to offer?
Well, there are several perversions of democracy associated with the House, one of which was anticipated by the Founding Fathers, one of which was not. What was anticipated by the Founding Fathers is a concern for stability in policy, that passionate majorities might change for every 2 years, and there would be wild swings in prospective policy as a result of these wild swings in popular passions. That was of a concern, and the Senate was thought to be the saucer that cooled the tea, to use their metaphor. The other concern, which the Founding Fathers did not anticipate, is gerrymandering. And it's not at all clear, God, especially in the modern era, that majoritarian principles are preserved. And so that the House is not the neat solution. I mean, if you had a House along with a National Electoral Commission that somewhat objectively, quote unquote, determined both the number of seats, the apportionment of seats on the one hand, and the districting within states, that's one thing. But under the current way of doing things,
not so much.
The second is just the constitutional hurdles of reducing the extreme malapportionment of the Senate, much less getting rid of the Senate. The constitutional hurdles are just so high and so controversial as to be. I mean, if our proposal is a proposal that would pass when pigs can fly, that proposal is even more ludicrous.
Okay, so let's think a little bit about what politically stands in the way of your proposal passing. If we're right that the proposal in the main stands to benefit Democrats and its effects on Republicans' ability to pass their agenda are unclear, how are we ever going to get, absent a massive Democratic supermajority, how are we ever going to get this thing adopted?
Two responses. One, if the 2022 election were to run contrary to form, and the party of government, the Democrats, were to pick up seats in the Senate, they'd only need to pick up a couple to make Sinema and Manchin's votes less important in order to approve this policy.
Provided they do so exercising the so-called nuclear option.
That's right. They would have to debilitate the existing filibuster rule. And the nuclear option would be the way forward. And it would not involve changing the Senate rule. It would be changing a Senate precedent.
This is what was done in order to get rid of the filibuster as it relates to judicial appointments. So this is about your proposal is to extend it to all laws. What is the difference between changing the rule and changing the precedent?
Well, changing the rule currently requires 2/3 of those present in voting. It's a very high hurdle. The method by which the Senate evolves is by precedent. So a ruling is made by the chair, the presiding officer of the Senate, and that ruling becomes the contemporary interpretation of a rule. So in this particular case, and it does mimic what the Senate Majority Leader did in 2013 and the Democratic Majority Leader and the Republican Majority Leader in 2017, I guess, to get rid of the filibuster for judicial appointments, is to, if there were a motion to proceed to a vote, and that motion got 56 votes, let's say, the presiding officer would say, the requirement is 60 votes. This motion only got 56 votes, therefore the motion fails. There are a few other technical steps, but then the majority leader, Chuck Schumer, would stand up and said and move to appeal the ruling of the chair. The motion to appeal a ruling of a chair is not debatable, so it could not in turn be filibustered, but rather you proceed directly to a vote. And if Chuck Schumer had lined up his majority appropriately, a majority would vote to reverse the ruling of the chair. It would only take a simple majority to do that. And the chair would then announce that his ruling or her ruling had been reversed and that the new claim was now the current method by which the Senate proceeds. So it's that would become the new interpretation of Rule 22.
This doesn't sound like the requirement that pigs fly. This seems doable, no? I mean, as you say, they pick up a couple of seats so that Manchin and Sinema are not pivotal any longer, they being the Democrats, in 2022, in the aftermath of seeing efforts to launch an investigation on the January 6th insurrection and efforts to attend to climate change and immigration policy, all dying at the hands of a filibuster. And everybody goes out and reads your paper, right? And says, yes, there is a better way. Are you hopeful?
Well, I think practically speaking, what I would hope for in the current Senate, I don't think it's likely in the current Senate. What is conceivable is that Senator Klobuchar, who is the chair of the Senate Rules Committee, would hold hearings about the filibuster. And this could become part of the conversation. And if lightning struck and in 2 years' time the election produced a 54-seat Senate, the Democratic Senate, then it is conceivable that it could be accomplished by the method I just described, by the nuclear option. The danger is in the next Senate after that, if the Republicans were to regain control, they could, by exactly the same tool, the nuclear option, reverse that result and reinstate the filibuster or reinstate simple majority rule.
And yet, if that's the Republican response, what they've most likely done is tied their own hands at the time that they have a majority, or at least not improved their lot. And if the kind of we enter a kind of a new equilibrium in which whoever has the majority makes this move, instates, reinstates, fine by the Democrats.
I think that's actually a really important point to make. That is, once the toothpaste is out of the tube, it's not clear that any majority has an incentive to put it back into the tube.
Really interesting interview, and And as always, we were not disappointed. We got a really good Ken Shepsley pun in there. Among political scientists, I think Ken is pretty famous for his puns. So there is something funny, you know, if you think about the history of why we have the Senate, there is something funny about this proposal. The intent of the founders was never for the Senate to reflect the population at large. The intent of the Senate was always to represent, you know, maybe disproportionately represent small states. And it was a bit of a compromise, right? It was the House was going to be the one that was the very majoritarian institution. And then the Senate was going to be where if there is some bill that's going to disproportionately affect, you know, some minority interest in Wyoming, the senator from Wyoming gets to stand up and have a little bit more influence there. And so the founders always intended for that to be the case. And we're here saying it feels undemocratic to us. The authors actually use that word. The Senate said it's an undemocratic institution. It's not obvious to me that supermajoritarian institutions are undemocratic. You might support democracy, but want your proposals to be supported by a supermajority rather than just a simple majority.
Yeah, I think they invoke the founders in two different ways. When it comes to majoritarian rule, they side with the founders because they say, look, the founders weren't interested in supermajoritarian requirements for typical legislation. That was meant to apply to things like impeachment, or if you want to remove a member from Congress, you have these supermajoritarian requirements. But they didn't say that we need this for just passing everyday laws, and they were right to think that. But the authors then say, you know, they're really troubled by the original design of the Senate, which makes the good people of Wyoming grossly overrepresented on a per capita basis relative to the good people of, say, Texas, New York, or California. And I guess my own view is that I think that you're right, that one could side with any number of thresholds. I mean, it's hard to side with anything less than a majority to say that's what you need in order to actually pass bills and have it be consistent with democracy. But to say that the Senate as an institution is undemocratic, I think there's a lot of evidence that suggests that. I mean, again, precisely because small states are so grossly overrepresented by this one institution. And so when you see things like the tax cuts being passed or the last three Supreme Court justices being appointed with a majority of senators who represent something considerably less than a majority of the larger population, we ought to be troubled by that from a small D democratic perspective.
And, you know, I looked at the paper. I don't think this was present in the interview, but in the paper, they do have this discussion of small states and should we give them disproportionate power. And what the authors try to argue right now is that nowadays, actually, all these cleavages that opened up and all these disagreements that we have in the U.S. are not falling along the size side, that it's not that small states have more in common with each other than with the larger states. I don't know whether I'm truly convinced by this argument, but, you know, if you can make this argument convincingly, then I think the answer to your question, Anthony, is yes. The situation we have right now, it's no longer as democratic as it could be because there's no reason to give more power to small states any longer.
I mean, it's interesting to think about this proposal in light of our conversation with Jonathan Rodin, who is talking about the increasing urbanization of the Democratic Party and the extent to which our political cleavages are becoming increasingly, you know, split between urban and non-urban America. I guess one unavoidable thing about this is that any discussion of this kind of reform is going to feel partisan in the sense that this is surely going to benefit the Democrats. The current way things are divided, any Democratic majority in the Senate is surely going to be the majority of the U.S. population. And any Republican, you know, unless the Republicans have a real supermajority of the Senate, they're probably going to have a minority of the country. And so this is a proposal that makes it easier for the Democrats to pass their proposals and makes it notably harder for the Republicans to pass their proposals. That might just be unavoidable, but it's hard to separate the partisan politics from the, in general, is this a good idea? If you didn't know anything about, you know, our current partisan politics.
But we can do that. I mean, I think that you're exactly right. It's that right now, this rule would redound to the benefit of Democrats, but it's relative to a status quo that is biased against the Democrats from a small D democratic perspective, right? It's that if Democrats lose just one seat, all that happens is they lose one seat in 2022, then the Republicans will have control of the Senate. But in doing so, we're going to represent a minority of the population, and that they should, in representing a minority of the population, should be able to pass all kinds of laws. That ought to give us pause.
I agree with Anthony that sort of people who are more aligned with the left nowadays wouldn't be probably talking about those reforms if they were not benefiting Republicans. But I think I agree with Will that we can still try to separate it. And, you know, suppose that they pass this proposal and suppose that we are operating under this rule for 5, 6, 7 years. What would be the view of the society of this proposal and of this change? And would they support reverting back to business as usual? And then I thought that actually, look, we are a democracy, so we should have rules that represent the view of the majority of the people. I think this is something that really appeals to people. So I'm guessing that perhaps it would be hard to implement this proposal, but once it's in place, I think it would be hard to get rid of it exactly because it's appealing to what we usually think of as democracy.
In a legislative process in which you've got to pass not just the Senate with a majority vote, but you've also got to get through the House, and it's got to be the same bill, and then it's subject to a presidential veto. And if it's vetoed, then you have to get supermajorities in both chambers in order to override. And you'll still be subject to the scrutiny of the courts. And so in this way, right? I mean, like...
Are you trying to depress us, Will? Like,
yeah, so I mean, it's really
worry,
hard
you know,
to
we can grease the wheel, but
yeah, I mean, this is about
change.
Getting a majority in just one chamber that's embedded in a much larger process, right? And so the idea that this was, you know, all the wheels are going to come off, we're going to start careening into all kinds of policy volatility strikes me as a gross exaggeration. Neither of you have said it, but plenty of people who talk who against, you know, in favor of maintaining the filibuster argue on behalf of it on those grounds. But this is about introducing majoritarianism into this one place in the legislative process that doesn't have it right now.
I think you're probably right, but I think there might be a lot of Americans who would like to go further and make it, you know, even harder for the Senate to pass things. So they might understand the population, you know, rationale behind this, but they might say, I like the fact that you need not just 50% of the senators, but you need 3/5 of the senators. There is lots of political polarization among our elected officials. A lot of them are extremists. A lot of them are pretty far out of touch with the typical American. And so there might be a lot of people who say, you know, I don't like the proposals that a simple majority of one part, you know, of the Senate can come up with. But I would probably like a lot of the laws that, you know, if you got 10 Republicans on board, maybe that would be a better law. Maybe they would like some version of this where you actually need 60% of the U.S. population on board in order to get a cloture vote as opposed to just 50%. So maybe there would be people who think the population part of this makes a lot of sense, but they still like the supermajoritarianism in the Senate as a way to combat the extremism that you have among elected officials.
And by people, you mean you. I mean, you have those views, right? I mean, not just you, right?
I'm not trying to say you. I mean, I don't want to say that my views line up with the typical American, but I think there are lots of Americans who are pretty moderate, who are well in between the two parties, who don't like the proposals of either party very much. And so they think that they like these supermajoritarian institutions insofar as it requires compromise in order to make major changes.
Hey, if you're getting a lot out of the research that we discuss on this show, there's another University of Chicago podcast network show that you should check out. It's called Capital Isn't. Capital Isn't uses the latest economic thinking to zero in on the ways that capitalism is, and more often than not isn't, working today. From the debate over how to distribute a vaccine to the morality of a wealth tax, Capital Isn't clearly explains how capitalism can go wrong and what we can do about it. Listen to Capital Isn't, part of the University of Chicago Podcast Network. So I'm troubled from it from a slightly different angle, which has less to do with representation of interests, but more just in terms of the practical challenges of governance. What I'm concerned about is that when you have these supermajoritarian requirements, particularly in a time when the parties are not just polarized, but intransigent and posturing and unwilling to compromise, that it just makes it all but impossible to get anything done. The capacity of the government to meet really profound challenges that we face. And there are many of them, immigration to climate change to incoherent tax code, on and on. It just, what this supermajoritarian objectively yields is intransigent and gridlock. We can't do anything in one direction or another. Now, I don't want to take that argument too far, because, I mean, obviously one solution to that is just say, well, a majority of one person then can do whatever they want or vest all authority in the president. And then we get around that problem.
Someone
I don't want to go
that
route. What's that?
Someone said that. Someone has a book on that.
No. It wouldn't be me, but...
I know.
But look, that's where, like, relaxing this to a majority in the Senate, recognizing, again, that still you got to get a majority in the House. Still you got to get the president's signature. Still you've got to survive judicial scrutiny before anything kind of takes hold. That strikes me as finding that right balance between, on the one hand, not wanting to cater to the whims of any one small unrepresentative group in government, while on the other, allowing for the possibility, regardless of who holds power, the possibility of elections mattering and us being able to meet the challenges that stand before us.
Perhaps actually this proposal might be altered to go a long way to sort of dissuade both of your concerns. So I would like some changes that actually make it easier to govern in this highly polarized climate. But there's always this high polarization in the background. And, you know, if you listen to Ken, what he says is, look, my proposal might actually indirectly lower this polarization, because right now Republicans, because of this malapportionment, they know they can hold power without really trying to appeal to the median voters. So they can hold pretty extreme views, they can appeal to pretty extreme groups, and they still are in power. And in fact, that might actually facilitate them staying in power. Their proposal, by shifting power towards larger states, makes certain larger states more attractive to Republicans. And he suggests that perhaps over a series of election cycles, we will see Republicans going a little bit more to the center and their positions reflecting a little bit more the median voter.
And then the corollary would be that the Democrats would then be able to go even further to the left if they wanted to. They could say, we care even less now about voters in Missouri and Kansas because we really don't need them anymore.
So that's assuming that you know, there's this huge divide, that California is really super leftist, the median vote in California is super leftist, and in Wyoming is super rightist, which I don't think that's right.
Yeah. I don't think the median vote, but I think the typical Democratic member of Congress is very leftist and is way to the left of the median voter in California and would view this as an opportunity to further shift to the left because now we have to care even less about voters in small states.
Well, so they still, I think a typical, you know, Democrat from California does not care about voters in the small states even nowadays.
Well, think about the party leaders, right? The party leaders would have
that's a fair point, I think. But maybe it's because Republicans, at least this is what Ken was implying in his interview in the paper, maybe it's because Republicans, you know, do not compete as strongly as they could in California, because it's easier for them to compete in Wyoming and to take, they take these more extreme positions and then they win Wyoming hands down. But if they start competing in California, perhaps Nancy Pelosi will have to move more to the center because they will have now real competition. And if that's the case, and again, you know, I see you're disputing it, and it, you know, it's also a little bit of wishful thinking, but if that's the case, if Ken is right, then we can discuss whether supermajoritarian rules have a merit or not. And I think there's an argument to make that supermajoritarian rules are as democratic as majoritarian rules, as long as, you know, we don't have huge polarization. And I think this huge polarization would be helped by the rules that Ken is proposing.
There's another way, though, that the introduction of this rule might lead to greater moderation and compromise, which is that when you have a threshold to do something that is so high that it's all but politically impossible to reach it, it encourages a kind of grandstanding by both parties, because there's no chance, there's no world in which we can actually pass the thing. And so let's just demonstrate our ideological purity and kind of thumb our nose at the opposition and cater to the basis instincts of average voters. And that if you lower the threshold and you say, no, we can actually get something done here. Well, there maybe that may lead to greater compromise. It may lead to the possibility of more constructive engagement. And that would be to the good as well. What do you think, Anthony? Because you're taking as given the level of polarization and saying, okay, we've got this high level of polarization. We wouldn't want to lower the threshold. But if lowering the threshold leads us to changes in kind of investment in resources in elections and changes in the parties and changes in how they interact with one another, then does that alleviate your concern?
Potentially. I think you're right. I mean, I agree with the points that you're making. I think you're right. To the extent that you could, mitigate the incentives for grandstanding and increase the incentives to let's actually get together and pass something and implement something and take some responsibility, I think that would be good. It's not obvious which way it goes. Theoretically, I think it could go either way. I think it's possible that this reform would cause the Democrats to be even more extreme with their proposals, or maybe it would mean, oh, now we actually have to fight harder to make sure we hold on to California. And maybe it makes the really important states in elections all of a sudden, or Texas and California and Georgia and Florida, and those are not all Democratic states. Maybe that would be interesting, but it's not obvious which way it goes. But I agree, it's worth thinking about how can we get legislators to take some more responsibility and actually get together and implement something, right? I mean, the thing you'd almost like to see is, we're going to put you all in a room. We talked about this for the Supreme Court, right? We're going to put you all in the room and you have to come up with something. And maybe things would actually end up looking a lot less partisan than they do in the current climate, where you can just kind of block things and say, Mitch McConnell can come out and say, my main goal is not to look out for American interests. My main goal is to just sabotage the Obama presidency and the Biden presidency. And that's obviously not a good thing for democracy or for the health of the country. There is one other thing that I think might be interesting to discuss. I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this. Is there a sense in which we worry that proposals like this would actually swing things the other way? At the moment, we think big states are disadvantaged in our political process, and citizens in California have less influence in our national politics than citizens in Wyoming, and we think that's unfair. Is it possible that it would swing it the other way? So here's, when there's a small Republican majority in the Senate, which Democrats are they going to appeal to try to get something passed? The Democrats in Vermont will be completely ignored because they won't have enough population to help the Republicans get past the cloture requirement. And so the Republicans will have to go to Democrats in California or Illinois or New York. That's where the votes are going to be had. And so you could imagine some kind of like corrupt pork barrel kind of bargain where this swings things in favor of those big states because now they get to be bought off every time there's a, that's the concern I have. I know that the status quo is not great either, because I know the status quo shifts things in, against the big states. And so maybe you'll say this is just going to even things out, but it's conceivable that you could actually swing things the other way and this could end up being unfair in the other direction, right? I mean, if we had a weighted voting system where I got 3 votes and each of you got 1 vote, that doesn't mean that I have 3/5 of the power and you each have 1/5 of the power. I give all the power because whatever I want. And so is it possible that the same kind of thing could happen where these couple big states can essentially get a really disproportionate extent of benefits and influence in the other direction?
So I think I'm with Anthony on this one. So, earlier I argued that I like the idea of requiring that, we need at least senators representing at least 50% of the population to pass any bill. But I like the idea, I like the concept, but where I fall together with Anthony is that we are introducing this solution only to remedy some other solution that was implemented a long time ago that disproportionately gives power to smaller states. And every time you use a solution to a problem that's sort of like a not direct solution, you introduce unintended consequences. And, it's hard to figure out which way this will fall. Yeah. Are we going to undo it precisely so that at the end of the day, we are more or less, one person, one vote? Or are we going to overdo it? Or are we going to underdo it? I don't know. In the current climate, it's really not a good idea to put forward proposals that obviously benefit one party, because that's going to lead to even more partisanship, I think. But I strongly believe that this other part of the proposal, which is let's get rid of the filibuster, let's say there are only, you only need 50% of the senators in order to pass a bill. I still firmly believe that's the good part, because I think it's going to change the competitiveness of the US elections. It's going to, as Will said, it's going to raise the stakes. No longer can I say that Democrats will always take your guns away, because now people will see that Democrats will not take the guns away when they are in power. And no longer will I be able to say that I'm going to, save the environment and actually introduce high taxes on pollution if I actually have to do it once I'm in power. So I think that's my position. In theory, I like the proposal overall, but this part, the partisan part, worries me a little bit. So I think in practice I would nix it.
So, I'm all in on this proposal.
Right,
I mean, I think it's
us.
Terrific. I think it's the best thing on offer. I agree that, and I put this to Ken. I said, look, I mean, if we want to really solve this problem, why don't we just shut down the Senate entirely, right? And then simply go to a straight majoritarian unicameral Congress. And then he said, yeah, but there are these pathologies in the House as well. So, okay, so maybe the answer isn't just that. But we could completely reconstitute Congress and build it anew from first principles. But we're not going to do that, right? That's just completely not in play. And so the question is, how do we preserve the Senate but temper its worst biases associated with malapportionment? And this moves us in a step in that direction. A world in which you have a bare majority today of Republicans who don't represent a majority of the population, is that they have to make a decision. Do I want to get 3 or 4 Democrats from smaller states who might be more moderate, or 1 Democrat from a large state who might be more liberal, to try to curry their support in order to be able to invoke cloture? And it'll be interesting to see who they turn to, how they actually build out that supermajority that they would require in order to represent a majority of the population. I don't know exactly how that would shake out. At the margin now, though, whoever is pivotal is obviously now in a position to extract rents. I don't know how we get around a world in which somebody isn't in a position to extract rents. That today they benefit the Democratic Party doesn't mean that they'll always benefit the Democratic Party. California in the 60s was solidly Republican. Texas is trending purple. It's not trending blue, but it's trending purple. It may come into play. To my mind, we got to have the kind of courage of our convictions and to say, not just with regard to who's going to benefit today, but what is a way to both recover majoritarianism within the Senate while avoiding the kind of pervasive gridlock and allow for the possibility for a federal government that can actually meet contemporary challenges. And this, of all the solutions that have been on offer, strikes me as the best one. I'd have real worries about getting rid of the filibuster altogether for reasons that they lay out, just as I think living in a world in which we, you know, reify 60% or 55% certainly doesn't have an edge vis-a-vis majoritarian rule from a small D Democratic perspective. So I'm all in on their proposal. I think it's good. But that sounds like a bottom line, doesn't it? And we're getting ahead of ourselves.
You've already given it, yeah. So maybe we're done.
Yes.
Well, do you guys have, let me ask, do you guys have a bottom line? Maybe it's with regard to the proposal itself, or maybe it's with regard to something more general about the paper.
I think I've given my bottom line too, which is that, you know, which, I mean, I think if you asked me, you know, I could flip a switch and make this happen, I'd probably do it. I'd say, yeah, let's try it and see how it goes. I like, you know, I think it's probably worth doing it. It's probably better than the alternatives, but I have those lingering concerns. I have the lingering concerns that, one, it's just a partisan proposal, and it'll be kind of perceived by the typical American as a highly partisan move that wasn't made out of good principles. And, you know, and two, maybe it will shift things in an unfortunate direction. Maybe it'll give too much influence to the big states, or it'll, you know, it'll mean that Democratic Party elites care even less about catering to any kind of non-urban interests. And I think that would probably be a bad thing. But I'd be willing to try it. Given, you know, I think I agree with the spirit of your argument, Will, and I think on net I end up coming out in that direction.
Okay, so you have the switch though, Viola. You've got the switch in front of you. You can do it or not do it. Are you gonna flick it?
I'm gonna flick it for 3 reasons. I'm guessing 2. So one is I want to flick the switch on just 60% requirement for any passage of any bill. Like, I think, even if you get rid of the first part of the proposal, the second part of the proposal is good enough that makes me vote yes. The second reason is, even if I have qualms about this requirement of majority of population, senators representing majority of population, I think because it disadvantages Republicans, they are going to get rid of that. As soon as the power goes into the Republican hands, they're going to say, no, let's get rid of this requirement, and we are back to 50% majority requirement. And I like that. That's already an improvement over the status quo in my playbook because of this all the other general effects general equilibrium effects that we discussed, that probably it's going to decrease partisanship and increase accountability. So yes, thumbs up from my side. And there was a visual here, which doesn't carry across, I guess.
Okay, well, there we have it. It's done.
Thanks for listening to Not Another Politics Podcast.
Our show is a podcast from the Harris School of Public Policy and is produced by Matt Hodapp. Thanks for listening.